Welcome to Safety Sisters, the podcast about the people who keep you safe at events and beyond. Meet Olivia, a facilitator at the intersection of arts, digital, charity and government spaces. We explore the power of facilitation to create safety, empower people and make big change. We discuss what it means to feel safe in meetings, to be heard, to have honest conversations, build authentic relationships and use those tools to make real shifts in the world. We also walk the talk by walking as we discuss the power of meetings outside of the boardroom. Olivia always gets me to think outside of the box with her unique skill of triggering untapped insights, and I hope this conversation inspires you to do the same.
Yeah, walking and talking has been quite sort of strong part of my work life, actually. I'd say probably for about the last 10 years. It's felt subtle in some ways, because I know that there are people that have it at the forefront of their practice. But actually, I think it sort of pops up and goes back down and, just manifests itself in different ways. So one of the things I wanted to mention where it sort of felt like it started a little bit was sort of sound walks. And this was at a point when I was doing a lot of creative work within the sound art discipline. And sound walks being something in between like a kind of audio tool that you might listen to on headphones, where you have a narrator or a guide, but actually they're quite a little bit more experimental, and they might use like field recordings in different ways and get you to just listen to your environment. Wow. and have an experience in a different way. So that's kind of solitary in a lot of ways, but I have experienced them, that kind of thing, in groups as well, and they feel really nice.
So why do people, like, you know, what's the purpose of doing these walks and talks rather than sitting around in a meeting room? Ooh, we're going through an echoey space.
I think we know that walking and talking is good for us. You know, there's so much evidence in terms of the mental, physical, health positives. But I think there's a few other layers. And what I'm really interested in is kind of what happens when we connect, like, in motion in different locations. So the next time I started to use walk and talks after sort of creating these sound walks was on a creative residency, which was a big oral history project. So collecting the stories of like staff and patients in these now no longer hospitals in King's Cross in London. And what we were noticing was it was a 3-year residency. So at the beginning, we were doing these interviews, but we were doing them in quite a traditional way, like sitting down in a meeting room. And yeah, just, I guess, interesting, of course, to have those conversations, but felt quite stagnant, really. And then, of course, you realise, well, you know, we're in this beautiful building, this hospital in this particular case, let's explore it. And so walking and talking became interviews, oral history interviews. We noticed the kind of richness that was happening. So we were able to walk side by side with someone, and they somehow felt a bit more at ease. Like you're not looking at each other in, you know, face to face, like directly over a table. And that sort of felt like there was a breaking down of, you know, some maybe power that we sometimes feels visible or invisible, I don't know. But so it kind of felt a bit more democratic. It felt like, I know from my experience as an interviewer, which was my role at that time, I always felt like a little bit like, you know, oh, I've chosen the questions, or I'm leading the conversation in some way. But actually, in a walk and talk, you're sort of also being led by each other in conversation and
yeah, there's like
physically.
A constant kind of democratic process, isn't there?
Yeah.
Of like where you're going, where you're walking to, the speed you're walking at, because you're maintaining that balance between each other.
Yeah.
Which is such an amazing way of, as you said, breaking down those power dynamics of, you know, traditional meetings that are around a table and increasing that sense of safety in ourselves to be able to say the things that we might not have said if we were around a table. But then also more experienced people or newer people into whatever role are becoming more... It's giving everyone a more of a level playing field.
I think so. And I think, you know, it's you're navigating things together, aren't you? And so also, I think, you know, just conversation in itself, especially when you're talking about yourself, can feel quite vulnerable and intense. And it's quite nice to almost have this other thing that's happening. I mean, just in that same hospital project I mentioned, we were doing lots of conversations as well that were sort of activity plus talking. So we found out that actually a lot of the nurses there were really into knitting. So whilst they were having knitting club, we would also interview them as well. And we noticed, again, we were getting so much kind of richer, I guess, stories and experiences from them in that kind of way. But yeah, there's something as well just about, I think, the walking aspect. The geography, because I think there's so much around walking practice as a theory. Like there's the psychogeography aspect.
Psychogeography?
Yeah.
What is that?
Well, like, I think, you know, you go back to, is it like, you know, vagabonds and the flaneur, like this kind of French sort of literary character of these people that walk the streets and, you know, explore and navigate on their own and sort of, yeah, quite, I think it has quite a romantic aspect, like from before. I think also it's interesting because when we look at it in a contemporary way, not everyone can walk the streets as well when you think about safety, actually. So I know that, you know, when I was, where I grew up in South London, didn't feel safe to me when I was a kid. And I sort of remembered that again just recently. I don't live far now from where I grew up, but I don't often go back there. And I sort of stumbled by accident. I just kind of got a different bus, got the wrong bus, and then before I knew it, I was walking past my old primary school and all of this stuff. And what was coming up actually was just a lot of fear, sort of walking around the streets, and just reminded me that actually this is not a great place to just be roaming in that like romantic way. So yeah, I think there are, you know, considerations when we think about walking and talking, and like, you know, what are we looking for, how are we feeling protected or not protected, what area are we in? You know, there's so much that comes with it as well.
Wow. And just interesting how you, like, you know, sharing now that you didn't feel safe, like, just going to school, you know, didn't feel safe kind of walking the streets going to school, and just this sort of concept of, you know, different people's perception of safety, and like, you know, what does being safe mean to someone, and how safety is relative, but it's also not relative. You know, like in the crowd safety, it's like if your intensity is more than five people per meter squared, you're not safe. But then, you know, there are high densities where people love being in a mosh pit, and other people don't love. Or, you know, you're in a room with a dog, and some people feel afraid and unsafe, and other people feel very safe. You know, so. But the thing is that it's when we're dealing with someone's perception of safety, we're meeting them where they are, right? It's not saying, oh no, you are safe. It's actually going, hold on, you are telling me you're unsafe. what can we do to support you and make sure that you are safe? And as a child, not feeling safe to walk to school, I mean, that's a fundamental issue right there that needs to be addressed collectively, you know. It's not for the child to solve. So, yeah, that's just a really interesting thing that you're kind of pulling out, and something that, you know, I mean, we were talking before about this PhD that we know is going on about looking into women's safety mm-hmm. on public transport, and just kind of that. And even as I was discussing that with you and a few other people, like, these stories start coming out and you realize how there's probably not one woman who has had a track record of feeling safe all yeah. the time on safety. So I know we're kind of already kind of diverting away from your role as facilitation, but actually we're not, because this is the key fundamental of your job, right? You're trying to create that safe space so people can share with you what would otherwise be, feel unsafe or feel afraid too.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the points you've just made there are really important, because safety feels different for different people, and it will feel different at different times in your life as well. So many different factors speak to that. And also, I don't think it's ever like an end point, if you see what I mean. Like, you can feel safe in a moment, but you might feel unsafe again, you know, in that same sort of setup. So I think I just wanted to acknowledge that. I don't think it's like, oh, we're striving for this thing and then we get there and we're done
and let's move on. Yeah.
I think it's just something that we hold and we keep an eye on and we work with continuously. But yeah, exactly. So safety, and I think a lot of it comes with relationship building. So, you know, the work that I'm doing as a facilitator is, for sure, I want to hear people's stories, because actually their insights will inform a lot of the social impact work that I'm doing, so that actually we're creating something that's needed, you know, something that we're hearing directly from community, from users. So, yeah, we want to hear genuine, I guess, kind of information, really. But also, I think it's going back to that, like, we're people. And, you know, to do good work together, what I've noticed is that it takes time, actually. And so to create safety, to create the conditions where we feel like we can be vulnerable, we can trust each other, then, yeah, it will be gradual. And it doesn't just kind of go, right, let's start this thing now, and off we go. So, yeah, that sort of start of a project. So I'm starting to think about walk and talks now in a professional context. So I've been working with a collaborator, Nadine Patel, and we've been setting up a civic creativity insights group, which looks at different themes. And the one that we've started off with is, yeah, how do we meet differently using walk and talks? Like, what happened if every project that you did at work started with a walk and talk instead of like an online meeting? Like, what happens if we just threw away the flip charts and the post-its and went to the park with, you know, the key stakeholders? So that has been brilliant, because the action research we've done has brought in a group of experts in this area to share what they know, what they've learned. And yeah, we're looking to see, the more conversations we have, it really chimes with people that it's just like, oh my gosh, you know, our world has changed so much that actually we can do stuff in a different way. We don't have to be like old school anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, the next step, I think, for us is taking the findings from this research, which will be around September, October time later this year, and then working with organisations to kind of go, okay, how do we work this walk and talk idea into what you need? Like, it might be, wow, you're doing a huge public consultation piece of work, you're an arts venue, how do walk and talks, how do you communicate with your community through walk and talks? Or it might be that, you know, you are an organisation that is wanting to do governance differently and your board members, and actually where does a walk and talk kind of practice fit into that actually?
It's
an exciting moment because we're getting really good response from people sort of saying, yeah, you know, that feels right actually to do things. We don't have the answers, and walk and talks are like ubiquitous, they're everywhere in different ways. So we're not like creating anything new. We're just kind of saying, actually, what happens when we bring something we know into a work environment see what emerges.
Yeah, no, that's really, really fascinating what you're working on. And what I love about it is the mundaneness of it, but I know that word kind of has a negative connotation, but it's just that, like, it's just so kind of human and foundational, and like, it just, you know, it's like, meet me where I am, and how we've kind of created obstacles for ourselves by all these kind of barriers of, you know, the meeting room and all that comes with it, in-person meetings or online meetings. And actually the challenge of, you know, the challenge of processes, and getting, moving through a process of any kind of planning for an event or a project or whatever, and how so much of that process could be simplified from something like a walk and a talk, due to people's like limitations and their barriers and their own personal sense of like being respected, being seen, being recognized, and actually feeling safe in themselves to say what they need to say, you know, like how much gets stalled by people not being honest, and not being honest because they don't feel safe to be honest.
Yeah, and essentially, you know, if we are being honest, we're doing like better work. We're being ourselves, and you know, that can only be a good thing. But yeah, you were just saying there around, like, you know, I think what I was hearing was just those aspects of just feeling like you can break away from those more traditional ways of doing things, but actually feeling comfortable in connecting in different ways. So like, you know, walk and talks is one way, but there's some work that I've been doing through like kind of the collective imagination practice, which I also really enjoy, that kind of very sort of expansive way of doing things differently. And what I love there is just this kind of like being free from the constraints that we're so used to of, like, right, you know, like, we're all meeting this group together who we're going to work together in some way. Everyone, let's do an intro. Let's do our icebreakers. Hello, I'm Olivia. I'm a facilitator. I'm standard stuff, right? And actually what I've been experiencing more and more through this type of collective imagination practice is what happens when we do away with all of that and we ask ourselves how to sort of intro, but using, like, you know, the reference point of what can you say about your ancestry, what can you say about your name, your actual name, and actually it feels quite far out, and you know, it is different and it takes more time, but when I've tried that with groups and we spend an hour and a half going around and hearing that. I mean, you can't help but feel connected to those people who are sharing. And, you know, what inevitably ends up happening if you've got a big group, the people that start at the beginning obviously share bits, and then it grows, and then the people in the middle have the confidence to grow a bit. And then by the end, like, you're getting some really deep stuff, which is really nice. But I do think that those, the impact it has is, I feel that I'm now able to start work with these people. Mm. We've just kind of, we've spent an hour and a half, which might be more than like a normal 5 minute intro or icebreaker, but we've kind of jump started a whole other process.
Yeah.
And also it allows me to reflect on like who I am a bit more. I'm like, yeah, what is my name actually? Or, you know, remembering where am I from? And these might not be things that I always, connect with people about. So that's really nice and enriching on a personal level too.
I love that. I mean, I'm just like, I keep having these flashes to sitting around a big like table organizing like a major event, right? Because this is my reference point. And just how there's so much expected of us. And I know that Emma Parkinson is looking at this in her PhD in Coventry, about like the way I describe it is like when you come into a control room, for example, when you go to deliver the event, you're expecting, you know, if it's like an American football team, it's like you're expecting Super Bowl level performance from a team that never practiced together. And it's like, hold on a second, how can you, you know, you need to like suss each other out, you need to get to know each other, how you work, because you're under such time critical pressure. And especially when something goes wrong, there's so many different agencies, so many different people representing different interests and different kind of roles. And you need to come together and make these really complicated decisions, complex decisions, potentially, to keep your crowd, to keep your audience, keep your crowd, keep these people safe. So, you know, this work that you're doing, I see how it can directly, indirectly impact the safety and well-being of thousands of people, whether at an event or not an event. Because of that connection, because of that impact. And like, imagine having that conversation with the police representative, the ambulance representative, and just being like, what's your name mean?
Yeah.
Like, what's your ancestry? Like, how amazing would that be to build that kind of, to start off at that level? I mean, just to even consider it, I think is amazing.
It is amazing. And I think in all, we're crossing the road now on a busy road. I'm feeling like a bit tense, but we've made it across. But yeah, it is an amazing thing to consider. But I do want to also be really super realistic, because of course there could also be the situation where people are like, excuse me, Olivia, what the F are you talking about? This is way too woo-woo. We do not have the time for this. And you know, it's does sound idealistic, and I think a lot of this practice is working in kind of spaces already that
primed?
You know, that are primed, exactly. But I think it's kind of moving into like a lot of like local authority work as well. So I just want to say that, you know, of course it's sort of things like this kind of surge up in particular places, but they do spread as well. And so I think, you know, we just have to be realistic that this isn't always just going to land beautifully for everybody. And we have to find ways to actually be like, how do we do a little bit of that that isn't kind of too much? How do we actually just be really confident, you know, with it, and just kind of go, yeah, that's what it is. And that's how I introduce myself these days. Or, you know, that's how I when I'm pitching for work, those are that's the kind of tone and narrative I'm going to go with.
Yeah.
Because if we don't, this is systems change, essentially, this work. So if we're not making these incremental changes in our day-to-day, then how does that sort of spread on a bigger scale?
Yeah. And?
Yeah.
And it has to change because the way we're going doesn't work, right? The bigger the defences, the bigger the egos, the bigger the, you know, of course you need a healthy ego, but like, it's just, you know, through my own experience of life, of my going through my career, you know, it's that kind of battleground. It just never gets, you just never get anywhere, and it's kind of pointless. And then you see people leave amazing organizations because there was just no space for that, like, respect for each other and willingness to be open to hearing different perspectives. And this is, you know, where a lot of discrimination and inequality comes in, because it's like, hey, you don't look or act like me, so I'm just going to completely disregard your, you know, what you say. And of course, like, from a neuroscience perspective, like, it's that whole safety thing, right? The brain, the amygdala goes, yeah, you don't look like me, so, like, alert. And then the prefrontal cortex comes in and goes, hold on a second, that's not the case. Like, you know, have that critical thinking. And of course, that prefrontal cortex doesn't mature until you're 25. So, you know, so, like, anyone under 25, you know, I don't think you really hold, you can't really hold people account to that level, because they just don't have that ability to regulate themselves. Anyway, we're digressing a bit. But I just think it is a really, like, what's that word? Photobombing a wedding. We're photobombing a wedding.
We just, let's. She's got a nice dress, though.
She does.
we just stand by the tree.
Yeah.
So. Yeah.
Oh, lovely. Oh, we can.
Well spotted. I wouldn't have really clocked that.
Oh, so sweet. Oh, I love the little bows in the back of her. Anyway, I can cut this out, or I can leave it in. No, you know, bit of character.
But the people thing you were just saying there stood out, of like, actually, you know, when it's like, when you see things being done differently, and if they chime with you, you can support it, and you can be vocal about it. And it's about sort of strength in numbers as well. So I definitely had an experience working in like policy world where the institution itself, I felt very unsafe. I felt like I couldn't navigate it or understand, like, it was just for me a really uncomfortable space. However, in contrast, I felt very safe in the team in that institution. So there was always this strange tension, actually. And just, yeah, the reason I felt safe in that kind of quite little bubble, in some ways, in the team bubble, was because, you know, I was doing things, I didn't come from maybe a route or a background into that work that many others did. And so I was just bringing a lot of stuff that I knew. And I was being supported, you know, by my line managers, team, and kind of saying, actually, yeah, this is good, this works in this context. And yeah, I was being recognized and validated, and it just gave me the oomph to carry that kind of work on. I did move away from there, but that's just me, like, I can't stay anywhere for too long. So yeah, I would just say it's that, isn't it? It's kind of,
I mean, support. Yeah, how many of us remember, you know, when you think about like the teams you've been in or the managers you've had, and I think you can like pick your good managers or good leaders or good teams, like, you know, probably count them on one hand, right? But those people just lift you up and just make the whole, just change the whole experience, you know, and allow, like, the times in my life where I've really grown in my work has been when I've had like leadership that believes in me, that sees me, that recognizes me, and then because of that push me to grow. Mm. And then like just even this feeling of like you have an idea and then people around you go, yeah, that's a really great idea, we should do that. Like, how often do people experience that?
Yeah, exactly. It's like that permission to kind of go like, yeah, just follow that. Go ahead. You know, it's not even like a sign-off thing that gives you like a oh, that was brilliant. It's just exactly like you say, someone just going like, carry on with that thought, actually. Yeah. And it doesn't have to
it's very
be
validating.
Anything more than that. So the other things I was just thinking about there was sort of when I do facilitation. So now I'm, you know, with clients in that kind of capacity where I'll come in as an external and I might lead a workshop, a session, an away day, something like that. And so I'm working with teams, you know, maybe just over like a couple of days. So I don't know them really, really, really well. But I do get to know them over that period, and I can see like when things click or when, oh my, it's amazing. But I do find for them to feel safe in those spaces, you know, for example, I really love having like rules of engagement, I suppose. Mm. And something that gives permission as well for people to be like, right, we're going to enter this space for whatever. It could be a couple of hours. It could be a couple of days. And, you know, what we're doing together is something whereby, you know, we expect each other to participate. We expect each other to respect whatever someone says. We, you know, all of that stuff. It's group agreements. It's whatever. You know, there's lots of different terms for that. But I do have to say, like, the word rules sometimes gets my back up a bit because I'm not really much of a traditional rulesy person. However, I learnt from the Art of Gathering book, Priya mm-hmm. Parker, and
life-changing book, by the
life-changing way. Seminal text. It really is, though, like, this, you know, yeah, this idea of like actually rules are really good mm-hmm. and they can be really useful. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for someone like I sometimes can't work out how to navigate things. Like that's what the example I gave of when I worked in an institution, I was just like, I don't understand how people are communicating. How I sometimes just can't get that, grasp that stuff quite easily. So I find rules quite useful to be like, okay, I'm okay to operate in this way. Yeah. And then I can flex around that. But yeah, so the book, The Art of Gathering, I think so many gems in there, but one of them was about actually don't be shy on kind of how you invite people into that space. And it's actually really helpful to be clear. Mm-hmm. And that in turn gives that sort of, I think, level of safety and trust to be able for them to participate, speak, you know, say something that maybe they've never actually said with any of their peers. And I sometimes see that, like, and that's what really gets me so excited about that kind of work, when something's clicked in them, because I don't have the answers as a facilitator. I am not the expert at all. I don't know. You're the expert. My job is just to bring out what I can from you. And the biggest part of that is just creating a space. I was almost going to say safe space, but you know, it's kind of, it's like brave space now.
Brave space. Oh, I love that.
Which I think is also a bit mixed how people think what brave space is, but
keywords.
But anyway, a container is another thing that people say, isn't it? Like, yeah, creating a container where you can be you, really.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, you know, you have rules of engagement, right? You know, you go to an event, there's rules, right? You can't bring these things in for your own safety and for the safety of everyone. And there's etiquette of how to behave. You know, if you're watching a show, like a theater show, for example, you remain quiet. I mean, if you're watching a music concert, it's okay to shout and sing. You know, there's like these different, and then like the mosh pit is the best example. There's so many unwritten rules, but by participating, you're engaging, you're agreeing to those rules, and those rules keep you safe and allow you to then kind of, you know, do what you need to do to release and have that wonderful escapism feeling and all that really, you know, the high energy, that joy that people people seek when they come to events, and that's what we're creating. And yeah, and then, you know, and then looking at those, you know, in organizations and how we work with each other, you know, by, like, I just now in my head I have a conference like a safety conference and or any kind of conference, right? And how you go to the conference and yes, it's nice to meet people, but did you really come away from anything, with anything? Because how many people really pushed through the barrier to say what they believed, to say what they felt? Like, how many people kind of toe the party line because it's like the energy and the way it's being designed means you're still on the defensive in terms of your energy. And then actually, we're not growing, we're not learning, we're just, I don't know, just, yeah.
Yeah, gosh, I was just wondering, actually, just hearing you about, like, you know, we've been talking about a lot about, you know, what safety feels like or looks like and creating safety
for the geese. They're not feeling safe right now. I think one's courting the other one.
But that's it then. What does unsafe feel like or look like? So, you know, can we recognize the distinctions, and actually how do we, I'm just curious actually about your experience as well, but like people do feel unsafe obviously at events or in working relationships and you know, what happens then? What do we do? Like, how do we...
Ooh,
yeah.
That's a big question.
It is big.
I love it.
Love it.
This here is the... This is the safety sister's question.
I think, you know, like, I would just say from a personal point of view that when I feel unsafe, I think the way it shows up for me is that I do retreat. So I will probably not be engaging, not be speaking.
Yeah.
And, you know, not that speaking is the best form of engagement, actually. Just to be clear, like, I think we can engage in other ways just by actually being present.
Yeah.
But, yeah, when I feel like something's a bit not balanced and not right, then yeah, I'm off thinking about something else, right? And whatever's happened in that time and space, I probably won't remember as well. I have a really bad memory, so that's not that difficult. But I noticed that when I am really there and safe, and it's stays with me, it really stays with me. But everything else is kind of easily forgotten.
Yeah.
But that's just my...
I'm just thinking about, like, the physiological... Like, when our autonomic nervous system is, you know, so the sympathetic nervous system is triggered, so the fight, flight, freeze. Fawn, I know, is a word used, but I know that word's kind of contested. But there is that sort of, like, chronic being stuck in that state, and that kind of fawning of where you're, like, pleasing the people around you to stay safe. So if I think about it in that context, like, I have fought to get my voice heard, and have not got anywhere. Flight, like, I have just gone, like, I remember working somewhere, I got a job, they headhunted me, I had, like, insane, like, 2.5 hour interviews, and, you know, I guess if I was more kind of in tune with my body back then, it probably would have been like, do not enter this room. And I remember being there like 4 weeks, and at the end of the fourth week, my entire body was like shaking, I was sweating, I couldn't think, and it was like, get out, like, you are not safe here. And I left, like, it was flight, you know. But it was kind of slowly building over those kind of couple of weeks of like, oh, what, you know, they hired me to like manage the team, but why are they sitting me in a position where like the sidekick of the owner was like watching my every move? Why were they telling me how to write an email? I'm like, this is really creepy. So, and then it just was like, you know, as you start gathering information, you're like, this does not feel right. But then I've had other jobs where it didn't feel right from the outset, but I watched my behavior change to fit in. And that has freaked me out the most, because we all look at something going wrong and we go, how on earth could this person take this action? And I am here to tell you that we are so easily psychologically manipulated, and we will very quickly sacrifice our values to fit in if we really want to fit into something. And so I sacrificed my values, and I was psychologically manipulated in this job to try and fit in. And then it kind of, the sort of haze lifted after a while, and I was like shaking my head going, what the hell am I doing? And like, even still to this day, there was like, when I first started this job, there was one person I connected with, and they're a really good friend to this day. And so we connected, and then like my manager, like over time, like manipulated me to think this person was like, didn't respect me, was saying bad things about me, was like sexist against me, when actually it was the other team that were doing all of that. And so this person who I clicked with, like I was their manager, and I treated them in a way that I have like since apologized so many times, and like one time just crying my eyes out. And like, I feel like I'll never actually be able to make up for how I treated him, because it wasn't who I am. Like, I was behaving in this weird way. And so like, it's like I'm living proof of being like, we can be manipulated so easily, and we can behave in a way that we'll look back on and go, oh my God, I can't believe you did that.
Wow, it's so complicated, isn't it? Because actually, it's not just about arriving to something and kind of like, I'm meeting these new people and how do we build trust?
Yeah.
It's like everything we come a lot, you know, with, isn't it? And just wanted to recognise that like, there are so many experiences that people feel daily, in terms of racism, sexism, you know, in terms of feeling unsafe. Like, we're just highlighting some scenarios, mainly in the workplace, but actually, yeah, they exist on all levels, and often consistently for people. But I think what you're saying there about just almost like, and it's taken me ages, but like recognizing like who are you, where are you from, like keeping that really central. You know, a lot of the stuff I've been doing recently is just, you know, yeah, again, remembering my heritage, remembering that actually I was brought up, you know, as the second generation of an immigrant family in South London, very working class. All of that kind of stuff makes me who I am. And, you know, I'm weaving that more into my own narrative and my communication with people, and I'm able to feel more safe saying that stuff, actually.
So is it coming back to like, are you anchoring the reference points of what the fabric of you to like create that kind of foundation, that safety foundation?
I think so, because I think, you know, some things aren't always visible and apparent. And I noticed that, you know, in the last sort of maybe 10 years or so, you know, in a work context, when I meet people, people will just have an idea of you, right? They'll just see you in a particular way and then start to be surprised about what your life experiences are and how, and you're like, oh, right. So actually, it's probably quite important to say some of this stuff, you know, because especially in the work that I do, this, it interconnects, right? The personal and the professional. I think it probably does for most people, but for sure, I see it and feel it. And I've noticed that it's valuable actually, having those really honest conversations. It's not about saying, like, oh, this is my experience, which overshadows your experience. But for sure, it's helps me to see why I'm drawn to things or why I might want to do a particular piece of work or not, actually, and then kind of say, oh, that doesn't resonate. And actually, that's good. I can probably, you know, it sounds very privileged. I can walk away from that. Well, you know, not everybody can.
Yeah.
And I definitely can't sometimes. And
yeah, but there's something in that, because it's back to, like, you know, creating those different foundations and, you know, the hierarchy of needs and stuff. If you're kind of not resonating with, like, a piece of work or the people around it, does that mean it's like you're not going to be recognized and seen and therefore are not going to be able to, like, give you and what you are, like, your talent, your skill, your ability into what that is, because it's not going to be recognized, it's not going to be seen, and you potentially won't feel safe in that environment. So actually, it's like it's part of that, the safety mechanism of our body being like, maybe these people aren't for you. And then by, you know, kind of just trusting that the right thing will come around, because it's, you know, fear isn't an emotion, it's actually blocking emotions, right? It's blocking our ability to really take in the bigger view. It narrows our view, and then, you know, when something does come in that is more resonating, and it's more like having the, it's like that, it's like that thing of, like, you're never going to be respected by someone else if you don't start respecting yourself, you know.
Absolutely.
You know, Eleanor Roosevelt quote that I always like to say, which I've now forgotten, that you can't make, nobody can make you feel inferior without your permission.
I've not heard that one before.
It's a really good one.
It's good.
And so the more I'm respecting myself, it's like you're kind of building up that battery, that respect battery, and that, you know, people resonate with that. And, you know, because if you're not allowing anyone to walk over you anymore, you're not going to attract those people anymore. If you have that self-respect, you're going to attract people who respect you. Like, that's just how it works. It's like the law, not just Murphy's law, but it's how it works, you know, because that's how we enter into these psychological dynamics, right? You know, you've got that persecutor, victim, and rescuer. And so every rescuer needs a victim, every victim needs a rescuer. So you can't have one without the other. So you're going to attract that. So if you break out of that game and go, you know, I'm stepping out of this dynamic and I'm going to respect myself, things start to change. And I've seen it for me. Like, I'm now, every contract that I have now, I really do feel, like, respected and listened to and kind of honored by the people who've hired me. And that's a huge change to what I've experienced in my whole life. But I put a lot of conscious effort into going, I'm not going to work in environments where what I have to bring is not valued.
You know, is that you know, it's taken me a long time to get to that point as well. And in a way, I often feel that speaking to younger people, like, I would love for them to shortcut all of this. And, like, can you get to that point earlier in life? Like, do you have to have had life experience? Because, yeah, of course you have to have felt it and experienced it. But I do think younger people today are more sort of aware, I think, of the kind of conversations we're having now. And are, this is a generalisation, but I think definitely broadly more able to be outspoken, I think, in the workplace than, say, when I was in my 20s, which... thank goodness that that's happening. It's small steps. It's still not, like, everywhere, and it's for the certain few, for sure. But yeah, I do wonder, like, wow, like, there were so many times when, so many in my career as well, where I just think, did that really happen? Like, most of it was just, like, shocking in a way, you know. And so, yeah, I guess it is over time. Like, some of the things I'm thinking about were 20 years ago, but then you still kind of stop and go, but still, that was incorrect on so many levels.
And is this, like, behaviour in the workplace or people?
Yeah, so I think it's behaviour from others in terms of lack of respect that we were saying. It's also, you know, and actually I think most of it is that, to be honest, largely. And a lot of it, I think, as well, comes from touching again on our own experiences. So I would say I was definitely always like a shy child. Like, I didn't speak up as a child. And I'm just like a really great believer now of like the importance of oracy in schools and kind of that we have a voice and that we should be using it from a really young age. Because I definitely was just barely able to say boo for many, many years. But yeah, so that stayed with me, I think, even into my kind of early years of work. But I think a lot of that had to do with also, again, just going back to, you know, like being from an immigrant family where you felt like you can't say anything. Like, you can't say anything, actually, because you've got a job. Yeah. Like, you know, and that's it. That work ethic was just like, well, but yeah, I do feel like that's less and less prevalent now.
Yeah. Oh, should we go that way?
Should we go this way? Should we go up this way? Yeah, it's quite nice, these big old trees.
Oh. And so with, you know, I mean, you know, we've worked together on a number of some big events. And then this year had an experience of producing an event where a lot kind of came to light about the importance of creating a safe container to actually allow for people to be honest. And this was reflected back by, because the people we were working with all work in the emergency services. And, you know, there was some experience shared of when they responded in a disaster and they felt unsafe helping, doing their job, you know. And actually, like, do we ever think about the people who come and help us? Do they feel capable and safe? And and actually, are they feeling respected and feeling like they're able to do their job? And actually, how can we kind of learn and grow together if we've just got our defenses up the whole time? And actually, how are we able to really kind of create lasting solutions for real problems like extreme heat and flooding and fire disasters, you know, stuff that is affecting every single human, and using what your work is to kind of support the advancement of these areas.
Yeah, it's interesting that kind of like, I would see that maybe as like frontline workers or, you know, and I always kind of think of them as in, you know, when you think, you know, coaches and therapists and all of that, they have supervision, don't they? And I always think, like, why does this not sort of exist for frontline workers? Like, because they're sort of they have supervision in terms of, like, they're obviously having difficult conversations with clients regularly. And I always just think, well, you know, these frontline workers are having a form of conversation constantly with people that is difficult. It might not be in verbally all the time.
Yeah.
And just how, like, that support, whether it's supervision or something else, like, I think it exists in some ways, and I definitely don't know enough about the sector to see, to speak on what's available out there. But yeah, like, just the question you were saying about what was the question?
It's all right.
About my work.
Yeah, like, about, in terms of your work of facilitating and supporting the advancement, like the kind of growth and journey of areas that, you know, are impacting, like, everybody's lives. You know, like I said, like, this, to use the case study of, you know, people who do planning for disasters or emergency response or things like that, you know, like, so.
I think I think it's I guess it goes back to sort of a lot of what we've touched on in terms of how do you create a space where you can step away from the day-to-day, right? And so where that's possible, I think that's really important, because that allows a bit of group reflection or self-individual reflection, because we just can't keep going, can we? Like treadmill-wise. And I think a lot of the facilitation work I'm doing is that opportunity. And I hear that so much from people that come to learning programs or different kinds of brainstorming, kind of thinking workshops. Oh, wow, it's been so great to just step out and think differently and come together in this way. And so, you know, a lot of it is having really great bosses that recognize the need for that. Because really, you know, I can't sort of force people to make the time in their diary. And it, all I'm really doing is responding to maybe some great leaders who are kind of saying, we need this, you know, and we'll have an external person come in. And that's where the value is, right? I'm impartial in that sense. I'm just guiding. And I've said this before, but that's the really important part of my work. And sometimes I definitely, you know, get carried away, but like one of the things that I think in terms of really great facilitation and helping people feel like things are working in that space for them is just bringing out expertise that's already within them. So rather than me kind of saying, and there's this really great, and suggesting things or being the hero essentially and kind of going, well, I've got this idea that, or, you know, that's, it's just never gonna I think stay with people. It's that coaching thing, isn't it? And I think that's facilitation and coaching always kind of go hand in hand in a lot of ways depending what your style is, but people are always gonna remember something that they have arrived at, that they have come to. So that tends to be where I see like the big smiles at the end of the day and stuff, where it feels like, you know, we did something there, we got there, you know. I didn't have someone just stand up there and tell me stuff, like why would I want an external person to come in and say, this is what you've got to do? Like, you know, it's getting there, getting there either on your own or together as a team, and just being nudged along the way, I think.
And do you find, like, when you do this work, different experiences when it's like online, in person in their work environment, or in person outside of their work environment, like, are there different, do you see different responses and different behaviors?
Absolutely. So the in-person side of things, either on-site in the workplace and then off-site, you know, if it's on-site, my preference is definitely off-site because of that kind of stepping away from the day-to-day. Of course, what comes with that is everyone starts to bond over, like, is the coffee okay? Is that, how did you get here? You know, so there's this quite, I think that's quite fun. But yeah, the on-site stuff I think can work as well. And I think you can actually, as a facilitator, start to help people see even the space in a different way. So I try to, I'm really particular about, before a session, I will want to go and see the space, or at least I want like a video cam or photos of the space, and the obviously the room layout itself. But yeah, if I can find a way of holding the session where it needs to be, but also building in little things like, okay, you know, in twos, you go to this place and you go, and making it a bit special and different, and using the little bit of the corridor that maybe people ignore normally. But so, and I think it's just trying to bring a bit of magic to what might be. And then online, I'm a fan of online, really. Like, yes, it's different. And yeah, since COVID, we're all like, oh, we're all sort of saturated. And yeah, it drains you in a different way. So for sure, more breaks online. but actually, you know, there is a level of accessibility there that some people will be able to join that wouldn't be able to in person. You have different digital tools that you can use.
Yeah.
So I like hybrid is not my favourite. So that, I think, again, we're not getting that democratic vibe, are we?
Yeah.
Where there's some people online and some people in the room
in
the same session. So it's either one or the other for me.
Wow. Yeah, of course, because there's different challenges and different opportunities with every kind of approach that you take.
And it's about really careful planning as well. So just, you know, we talked about rules of engagement and all of that kind of stuff for events and for these kinds of facilitation sessions, but it's also just like it takes time to plan well. And you know, I always get really surprised at like things that I've done many times and I still think, well, I should be able to plan this in like, you know, 6.3 seconds, right? but it's not, because you know,
like every event.
Yeah, like of course it's not. That's where the most of the work comes, because you want it to be, it's a skeleton, right? It's a structure. It's never going to be the thing. I think they talk about three plans that you have for like any workshop. It's the plan that you make before, the one that you do in the session, and the one afterwards, right? So there's like three versions of it. But yeah, I always tend to spend a lot of time designing it so that I just feel confident, actually, and I want everybody to feel like I've thought it through, and the best the best kind of feedback I get, and the very first time I heard it, I was like, oh, that's it, really, was when it was just like, Olivia, just you carry on doing what you're doing, we just feel like we're in safe hands.
Aww.
And to me it was like, that's it,
that's,
I just
nailed
want
it.
To get to that point.
So how did you find this work? Like it's, you know, like clearly it is so perfect what you're doing. And even from my own experience with you, I think you're a master at this. And to me, you know, it's a dark art of this world. I'm like, I can't even touch it. You know, I'm just so like, I come from like safety, right? I'm like, oh, barriers and and wands. And then, you know, you come in with this like magical world of like shaping and shifting energy and dynamics and like literally thinking outside of the box, like as in like a mile away from the box. You know, I personally am really inspired by how you think and how you guide people and how you like create that environment for people to to come forward and share what they need to share. So yeah, like how did you find this, or did you always?
No, yeah. Well, thank you, but I do definitely feel like I'm always learning, and you know, I have definitely come away on highs from session, but also on sort of bit like, oh, that could have been better, and that, I think, you know, that's all fine. We're just humans, so yeah, this type of work has always, facilitation has always been nested in everything that I've done. So I have, you know, produced many, 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 many events. So before that, I used to work in film production. So, you know, the level of detail in terms of putting schedules together, production
Insane.
Schedules and all of that stuff. So I had that kind of foundation with events. I did do a lot of like network management or kind of advisory group liaison, that kind of thing. So that's when it became much more like, whoa, stakeholder management, different people's kind of personalities and needs and wants. And then I think it was only really in the last year that I started to think more about what happens if I hone in on the facilitation work specifically.
Yeah.
That's what I'm doing now, is actually getting better at facilitating different kinds of groups. So they could be groups, but there's also kind of one-to-one that I'm looking at a bit more in terms of coaching. So I'm sort of upgrading my kind of certification in that area as well soon.
That's exciting.
So that will be next. And I'm thinking about sort of how to do things differently, like in that space as well. So whereas in facilitation, the stuff I'm kind of interested in is bringing like play into that space and what happens when we, you know, I guess introduce a concept like that. What does that kind of bring us in terms of, you know, how we might plan in the future? But also, with coaching, you know, again, how can we do things differently? And I'm really curious about voice note coaching as well. And like, again, it's that accessibility, like maybe not
every... How does that work?
Well, I'm sort of still exploring. I'm still exploring. Oh, this is called Paradise Street. Oh, that's nice.
Journey through London, ladies and gentlemen.
So
that sounds cool.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I think, again, I'm really interested in accessibility. So what happens when you offer an opportunity that's like, okay, I want to be coached, but, you know, I'm thinking about it from a parent's perspective. And I know that actually, I might want to have this coaching experience, but I might not be available every time, every week, because I've got to do some childcare stuff, or I've got to, whatever it is. And, you know, I'm just thinking stuff like voice noting each other offers a bit more flexibility for some people that might want it.
Yeah.
It also, again, people might want to engage, like they can go away, reflect, think on that nugget, you know, because, again, I'm one of those people that just... don't always have my best ideas in the moment, in the meeting, firing all cylinders. You'll hear me probably say, oh, that sounds really good. Let me just, if there's time to just have a think on that, I'd love to get back to you because I just need to process.
And isn't that such a like common thing? You come away and you're like, oh, I wish I said that. That's so wonderful to like create that opportunity to do that and take the pressure off of someone to, that's really powerful.
Yeah, it's a strange expectation, isn't it, that we have, that we're all have to, like, perform in the
now.
Moment.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I'm just, like, in a control room, you kind of do.
You have to.
Oh, there's, like, a lot of people outside this entrance. Oh, let me come back to you. Can I go back to you tomorrow? this
so
works.
True. It's kind of not going to be possible. But
in the planning meetings, you know, just...
Okay.
Yeah, being able, like, having that grace of going... Thank you for asking. I'm going to have to, you know, just give me some time to think about it. Because there is this, like, pressure to, I guess especially when you're, you know, once again, it's like that kind of feeling unsafe. So then using the fight analogy of, like, I need to prove that I'm really good and really competent, so I'm going to have an answer for everything. And actually, you know, what if you have it really shows that self-respect again and that self-confidence to go, I don't know. I'm going to look into that and come back to you, you know. Like you go for a site visit for an event and you're looking at the space and like it's going to take a while to digest everything and to see how people navigate in a space. And like for me, you know, with like built environments, you know, you're like, oh, you're putting a crowd management plan in the station. Yeah, okay. Like I'm not going to have all the answers. And also, you know, I don't know how people respond and react to an environment. I can look at a street and think they'll behave one way, but actually they'll behave another way because, I don't know, fumes coming out of one side, or there's, you know, in this level of sunlight, it's really hot on that side, so no one will stand on this. I don't know. You know, you just, you don't know what you don't know until you start to spend time. And, you know, it's like allowing that time to understand the subject. And to like sit with it and contemplate it.
Yeah.
Rather than seeming to know the answer straight away when you haven't even had time to get to know it.
Yeah, no, I love that. And I think that really chimes a lot with, I guess like iterative ways of working. So not this kind of, okay, we've got the plan at the beginning and let's follow that plan. And it's like, well, things might change, actually.
Yeah.
And along the way, you know, yeah, we might speak to A, B, and C, and they actually will discover things that will mm-hmm. change the plan. Or we might change, or blah, 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 blah. I mean, it's quite like that agile approach, which I really like when I worked in product development as well. That's what I learned a lot of, like, how can we create something, a chunk of something, test that in like a kind of short period of time in a sprint. Do we like that little bit? Yeah, okay, let's build on that little bit and make another bit and then make another bit, rather than let's make the whole thing, let's do it all, let's unveil it at the end, and then everyone's like, oh, that's not quite right, is it?
Yeah.
So, yeah, definitely time to kind of sit with things.
The antithesis to Mark Zuckerberg's move fast and break things.
Oh, is that his? Really?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
So I like this. The other way isn't working. I like this way of working.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. There's so much to this world. So much. And I love that our worlds are coming together, because I think there's so much that we can do by coming together with our two worlds and seeing how they can kind of support each other.
Yeah.
I'm really fascinated to
Yeah, and that's see it. That. Like, there's never just like a one size fits all, isn't there? Like, I think what we've talked about today, I am now just like more and more curious about, I think what stuck with me are things like, oh yeah, of course, like the control room and having to like respond in the moment. And, you know, there are so many jobs like that. And like, actually, how do you maybe bring in principles of the stuff that I've been saying into, like, I don't know, actually, because I've not worked so closely in, you know, your workspace. But now I'm really intrigued to sort of try out and test, you know.
Yeah. And it, I mean, like, it's a fascinating kind of area to study. And it's really great that, like, you know, there are people studying this as their kind of doctorates or studying this in other areas of work about just like the demand and the expectations on us in the control room, you know, in any control room, really, you know, especially when it comes to safety and security, and how, you know, thankfully the disasters are rare. But then when they do happen, like, do we already have, you know, that resilience and that ability to like have really good communications, that we're really gelled as a team to respond? Because time is of the essence, you know. And if you hear the stories after Manchester Arena attack, it took them like, I don't know how many minutes, it took them minutes just to figure out what happened. You know, there was a bright light flash in the CCTV, and everyone's going, whoa, what's going on? And you actually, like, there's this, you know, you read some plans and you're like, well, evacuate everyone in so many minutes. And like, you actually need those first few minutes just to figure out what happened. And even in those minutes, people are getting injured, people are dying, but you still have to figure out and get the right information, as much information you can, to respond in the best way you can in that moment. That is a huge demand on people who have probably had very little training in like communication and like emotional awareness and cognitive, like, I just, you know, it's like really taking that moment to go, hold on, do you see what's being expected of civilians, being expected to behave like military control rooms and military, they've got years of training.
Yeah, exactly. Like that sort of, I don't know, beautiful choreography, I guess, that you see doesn't just come out of thin air. Like we've been talking about, you know, when things go well, it's because so much work has been put into it. Like there are no shortcuts. Like I just firmly believe that more and more. Like, you know,
there are no shortcuts, as we literally hit a wall.
We've got to go around the other way.
That is so funny.
Yeah, go around the other side.
Yeah.
I
love that.
Yes.
They're also going to have to do
Yeah, they're going to have to come round. Or maybe they have a secret. Wait, no, they look so confident.
They do look very confident.
Hang on, are they going to shapeshift through the
They know something we don't. Yeah, sorry, go on.
Well, just, yeah, things take time. Good things take time.
Yeah, I love that. Say that
and
all the time.
We just need to build it in. We can't, like, rush things anymore. And so, you know, I know, again, this probably sounds really idealistic, but, well, maybe people that haven't been trained and haven't been working together for very long shouldn't be doing that kind of work, for example, you know. And of course, it's not as simple as that. But yeah, that's the kind of like systems change work that we're looking at, isn't it?
Yeah.
Where it's just for us to feel like humans, that we're doing well, you know. We've done it in a way for so long. Maybe we can just kind of nudge along and shift how we do it from now here on in.
Yeah, I agree. Amen to that, sister.
Amen.
Oh, well, on that note.
Yeah.
Thank you. I really enjoyed this. And as an addendum, wait, is that the word? Addendum?
Addendum sounds really good.
Addendum?
Addendum
jacket. Well, it said really...
I don't know.
It sounded really good until I questioned addendum. It. I should have just gone with it. You know, it's like this conversation today has only happened because you reflected back to me that safety sisters to you is so much more than what this kind of little tiny limited idea I had in my head of people who worked in event safety. And actually, you saying back to me that it's like it's anyone who creates that safe environment or creates that safe space. And you, one of the examples you used was like a catering company and how they create safety by feeding us. And, you know, so if you hadn't reflected that back to me, I potentially would, like, yeah, no, if you hadn't, I wouldn't have expanded my perception of what safety sisters could kind of develop and take in and explore as a subject.
Well, yeah, like now, I'm just kind of so interested to see how else does safety show up, you know, in different ways of kind of working, being. But yeah, thank you. I really enjoyed it too.
Yeah, no, it's always, always a wonderful conversation with you, Olivia. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoy this episode, please rate and follow the show and leave a review if you are on Apple Podcasts. It would mean a lot. For more information on my work in crowd safety, please see murphymorris.co.